As we approach the end of a full year of COVID shutdowns, teachers are looking to get back to normal.
Educators want nothing more than to be back in person with their students.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll get the results of a survey from the country's largest teachers union. We'll also hear about the consequences of behavior modification programs, and we'll spend an academic minute with gender-neutral language around the world. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Hard to believe, but it's been almost a year since schools around the country were shut down due to fears about the spreading coronavirus pandemic. Since then, everyone involved in education has been learning on the fly, almost making it up as we go along. Teachers who spent years in front of classrooms filled with students had to figure out how to put together a good lesson while also putting on an improvised TV show. Now, a survey conducted by the National Education Association, the country's largest teachers union, tried to find out how teachers are coping with the current hodgepodge of online, in-person, and hybrid classrooms. Let's talk about the results of that survey now with Becky Pringle. She's the president of the NEA. We spoke on the day that the survey results were released, and I asked what they hope to learn from the report.
Well, we have been talking about the need to return to in-person learning for over 10 months. You know, I have to tell you, Bob, that as a science teacher, I taught eighth grade, you know, the wonder years. I taught for over 30 years, and I know that educators want nothing more than to be back in person with their students. And all we've been calling for 10 months is putting in place those mitigation strategies that the CDC says need to be strictly enforced, all of them, for students to return safely to in-person learning. And we've been calling for that. We haven't gotten it yet, but now we have the vaccines. And that gives a lot of additional hope for this extra layer of support. And so we wanted to find out from our members how that was going for them. Were they getting them? Did they want them? Did they feel safer with them? And so we surveyed our members just most recently, and we found out that only 18% of them have now been vaccinated. And we also know that over 70% of them want to be vaccinated. But we found out something disturbing from the survey, and that was that over 75% of our members don't either have access to the vaccine or they don't have the proper information to be able to access the vaccine. They don't know who, what, where, how to get the vaccine. Lots of confusion and chaos. And that's one of the issues that we learned from the survey that we actually want to try to do something about.
Is this because everything to this point has been done as kind of a patchwork of states and towns and counties? Are you looking for a more federal response or at least a plan?
That's exactly what has happened. We had failed leadership, if leadership at all, from the top. But when President Biden was inaugurated, he promised that he was going to get control of the coronavirus, and he was going to partner with the states. He was going to partner with educators. He was going to certainly partner with and listen to the infectious disease experts to do all of that. And he started that work because what he inherited was a chaotic mess. And that resulted in, unfortunately, I know you've heard these stories of vaccine doses being unused, not being where they needed to be to begin to vaccinate those most vulnerable populations, not having guidance to call for, like the CDC has called for and he's calling for, educators being on that prioritization list those kinds of things he is now providing guidance from at the federal level. And so working in collaboration with state departments of health and state governments, we believe that we will get a more orderly distribution, that they will have more information, because one of the things he said he's going to do is make sure they know how many doses they're getting and when they're getting them, so they can accurately and effectively schedule vaccinations. So we're hopeful that that will change, but right now it is not organized in too many states, and it's creating a lot of confusion.
Is there any place or some areas in the country that are doing it right that you can point to and say, there, look, use that model?
We have been actually looking throughout the country to find a few things, and mostly what we are looking for is the adults in the system collaborating together, communicating with each other, being transparent about their plans. And so we've seen really hopeful models in states like Utah and even in Colorado, and to some degree in Michigan as well, where they are partnering, the governor's partnering with the superintendents, and they're partnering with the educators and with the unions, and with the healthcare professionals, with the infectious disease control, the American Academy of Pediatrics. I mean, they're all coming together. And they're working together, and they are all having input into the plan that they develop, and they're being very transparent, and they're adjusting their plans as needed. If infection rates go up or if there's a shortage of the vaccine, they're all coming together to try to do what's best for our students. So those places that are putting in place, those processes and practices for collaboration are doing much better than everyone else.
In places where there is some in-school, some in-class education going on, what are you hearing from your members? Are they satisfied with the way things are going, or is there a long way to go still?
It's really determined, honestly, Bob, by whether or not they are collaborating with educators, how well it's going. And it certainly is determined by whether or not they have mitigation measures in place. We have teachers in classrooms where they're buying PPE for themselves and their students. That's not okay. We know that the government, the federal government, the state government should be stepping up to make sure that that educators and students have the tools and resources they need to be safe and to stay safe. We also know that when there's been a lot of chaos where the students are in one day and then they're out the next day, or one wing of the school is shut down or one school is shut down, it not only creates chaos for educators and students, it creates a whole lot of chaos for our parents. And so if whether they're hybrid or whether they're fully in person, if that kind of chaos exists in the schools, then it is extremely disruptive and discouraging for our students and for educators.
Well, it sounds like your members are getting a little restless about getting back to class.
They really are. They want to be with their students. They really, really do. And they are looking to our government to make sure they have what they need to do that.
So where are you taking the results of this survey? Who are you showing this to and saying, see, let's do this?
So we're sharing it with our members, of course, and we're sharing with our state affiliates across the country. We're sharing with folks like you to help us tell the story of real students and real educators and real schools and how we can get back to in-person learning safely and equitably. And we're also sharing it with the Biden administration as well as with the CDC, because we want them to know as they make decisions what our educators are experiencing, so that they can make better and more informed decisions about what best to do next.
Becky Pringle is a middle school science teacher with 31 years of classroom experience and was elected president of the National Education Association in 2020. She took over the post on September 1st. In the late 1960s, behavior modification began to move rapidly into residential treatment facilities. The goal was to increase pro-social behavior as well as self-esteem in delinquent teens and lessen chances of them getting into more trouble in the future. Over the decade, these programs developed into privately run institutions that have become hugely profitable and are virtually unregulated. Each year, thousands of young adults who are deemed out of control, suffering from depression, addiction, anxiety, and rage, are carted off against their will to wilderness programs or residential treatment centers across the country. Journalist Kenneth R. Rosen spent 3 years investigating this industry, and his work led to the new book called Troubled: The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. Rosen has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, VQR, and The Atlantic. He is also a contributing writer at Wired. Kenneth Rosen spoke with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill about his personal experience with behavior modification and why he decided to take on this project.
Well, I had been a part of several Facebook groups that were memorializing the programs and people's time within them. And over the course of 2 years, I started to see an increase in obituaries and people posting about lost friends or terrible incidents that happened to former clients of these programs. And I had felt that I didn't quite fully understand my time at these programs, which I had spent about 288 days in three separate programs when I was 16 and 17. So I didn't understand my time in these programs if so many people were dying deaths of despair. So I went back and I revisited all the programs that I went to and tracked down a lot of the former clients that I knew from this time and tried to figure out what was happening to all these children, and what I found ended up being very disturbing.
You talked to hundreds of survivors of these programs and highlighted a few. How did their stories differ, or did they all echo the same situation?
I had set out to interview as many people as I could, and in previous reporting I found that when I start to hear the same narrative thread repeated by several people, I feel like I'm on the right track. So in this case, I had interviewed, as you said, 100 or so former clients, psychologists, counselors at the programs, parents, and many of them started to have a very similar narrative of trouble at home, lots of issues at home that then led into school, that then led to these programs. So I decided to go back and pick four former clients of these programs who exemplified most of the people that I spoke with. So the trajectory from a wilderness program to a therapeutic boarding school to then a residential treatment facility in the middle of nowhere, Utah, was a channel that many children took, and it was also the same place that they all came from. They all came from very difficult home lives, very difficult upbringings that then led to these later troubles.
You say the behavioral correction industry is nearly unregulated, and it's failed many of its clients. However, it's still massively profitable. How do these facilities and programs stay in business?
The programs have been able to survive, by and large part, through private funding through parents. They're able to accept direct funding from parents and not have to worry about being vetted by insurance companies, which won't cover such programs because they aren't evidence-based, and deal directly with the parents. They've also been able to stay around for so long because whenever there have been investigations into alleged abuse or deaths within the programs of young kids, they've always managed to chalk it up to, these were troubled kids, it was a task that was beyond our capability to handle, and we tried our best, but inevitably the child failed themselves. So we've seen this time and again since the 90s, that the programs place blame on the children and they continue to thrive because there's no serious evidence to the downfall of their own teachings and their therapy.
Why do you think parents continue to send their children to these facilities? Are they being misled, or do they not understand what the programs are?
I don't think parents knew what they were getting themselves into, but I also don't think that they were given an opportunity to truly vet the programs. When a child is so troubled that they're causing mayhem at school and mayhem at the house, it's difficult for a parent to see clearly. And when you're being told that there's a silver bullet or a golden key that can allow something to magically alter the behavior of your child, to turn them into the child that you know they can be, it's sort of deafening, right? You don't really hear much else other than that. And so they take the one road that's given to them after having tried so many other roads, after trying private therapy, after trying family therapy, after trying inpatient programs that are near the home. They've turned up nothing, and they only have one option left. So they weren't necessarily misled, but they were definitely desperate.
Was there someone that you highlighted in the book that really their story surprised you?
I think the most surprising thing to me about the stories in the book were how closely I felt connected to them. They really felt to me like my own experience at these programs. That's one of the reasons why I chose to write it this way, was because I could imbue the writing and the reporting with a really keen knowledge of what the programs were like and the emotions that these children felt. And I was surprised to learn that I had always been so wrong about the programs. For years, I felt that I was okay, that nothing bad had happened to me there, that I made it out unscathed, and therefore the programs weren't so bad after all. But sitting down with these children across the, you know, now adults, mid-20s, early 30s, sitting with them across the country and talking about their time there, I really started to hear them tell me my story, and it shocked me.
Still to come, Elizabeth Hill's conversation with Kenneth Rosen continues with a look at how these programs are being regulated, or, you know, not being regulated. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Kenneth Rosen, a journalist who has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, VQR, and The Atlantic. He's also a contributing writer at Wired. He's talking to The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill about his new book, Troubled: The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs.
Has there been any regulation put into place, state or federal oversight, a more rigorous hiring process? Any sort of reform?
There have been no federal or state regulations that I know of. There have been recent movements by the state of Oregon to sever a contract with a private at-risk youth treatment provider who was handling children out of state, out of Oregon. The legislator there was able to bring the children home and not put them into programs that were deemed unsafe. But generally speaking, they exist in most states across the country, a majority of the states nationwide, and are escaping a lot of these federal and state oversight committees, mostly because they can't investigate into programs for emotional abuse. You know, where do you begin with emotional abuse? And the kids were troubled to begin with, so are they exemplifying something new or just continuing on their troubled path? But hopefully, with the rise of awareness now being brought with my book and Paris Hilton's recent documentary on a similar subject, more and more states will take notice and things can change.
Do you think that they are programs that are worth saving, or do you find that it needs to be eradicated completely?
So I went into writing Troubled with the intention of a journalist and the experience of a survivor of one of these programs. And I made it very clear from the outset of the book that I wasn't, you know, a psychologist. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a counselor. I'm a journalist first and foremost. And I am hard-pressed to decide whether or not these programs should exist in their current form or a different form or some other sort of treatment option that's available. I know there are evidence-based treatment facilities statewide that can provide this sort of care at a more granular, personalized level. But some people's experiences there were okay. Some people's experiences there were not that bad. By and large, however, they were bad. And whether or not we can get them shut down, I just don't think it's a plausible goal. I think a better goal is to inform people to make a decision to then sort of starve the programs shut, perhaps, or to make them reform themselves, or to open their doors to more regulators and more investigative bodies, and have that as an opportunity for them to better themselves. Because there are troubled kids, people do need help. That goes without saying. But this isn't the kind of help they need.
Did you see similarities to gay conversion therapy?
Yes, I don't make I don't make that comparison explicitly clear in my book, but there are a lot of comparisons to gay conversion therapy insofar as a person is told that it is not who they actually are and here's who you should be, and expectations pushed onto a child rather than a person being fostered into the adult or person that they are going to be.
You go on to describe what has happened to the graduates, and I know you touched on it briefly. Could you talk about where some of these graduates are?
Yeah, a lot of them seem to exhibit signs of arrested development. They can't quite understand why things haven't clicked for them or why they have trouble holding down a job, or they always seem to get into fights with authority figures. They have tenuous relationships with their parents. Sometimes that manifests as, bouts of anger or violence toward the parents, or the complete opposite, accepting or subsisting off of their parents' income, right? So they're still sort of relying on their parents and haven't really grown up from where they were. Some of the situations more specifically that I saw were, in and out of prisons, in and out of jails, treatment facilities for increased use of drugs. It went from maybe marijuana and the casual drink in high school to heroin use and amphetamine abuse later down the line. And then, unfortunately, there's a group of children who couldn't make it into the book because they had died. Depression takes hold, and many of the former graduates have killed themselves or have overdosed. And that's probably the saddest part of all, is that the help that was intended to pull them through this tumultuous time of their youth ended up killing them.
From your own personal experience and talking to psychologists, do you have any advice for parents that are considering behavior modification programs for teens? Is there other avenues that they should look into?
I think first and foremost, it takes an honest, hard look at the family structure. Whatever's happening at home is by and large often the thing that's causing the issues within the kid. Whether it's a divorce that the child is going through and witnessing their parents go through, whether it's a new city or a town, or they lost a friend to one of the myriad things we were discussing earlier, or they had their heart broken and they don't have anyone to talk to. Small little things that have built up into this distrust of the family unit and the crumbling of the family unit, it's something that needs to be addressed early on. And I implore parents to really look at this structure and to take accountability for anything that might be happening in the house that they can help change to bring the children sort of back around to the kids that they knew them as before. Barring that, I think there's a lot of community-based options, CBT therapy, DBT therapy, all these things that are evidence-based treatment that have been used for decades that are covered by insurance, which tells you a lot given that these programs are not covered by insurance. And really making sure that the parents are going along with this therapy. It's not one-sided. It's not the kid that needs fixing. I think that's the real message here. It's the family needs to bond together to form a stronger unit to carry on into the future, because inevitably if you admit someone to treatment and they come home to a very same situation, they're not going to grow. They're just going to regress.
What can educators do for teens that are displaying troubling behavior?
This comes from me personally. I really found that being told that I had so much potential, being patronized often, that I, could do so much better if I were to just follow the rules and follow the path of my classmates, and I would be X, Y, or Z. And I always found that to be really detrimental. And I heard the same thing from many of the former clients that I spoke with. I think what needs to be done is fostering of interests. If a child is stuck in front of a computer playing video games, we should not berate them and say, you're wasting your time in front of this screen, you need to go to school. When we've seen time and again that there are classes and opportunities for video game designers, for people to write narrative scripts for video games, for people to be part of the computers that are made and built expressly for this purpose. We've seen that people play video games for a living now, and billions of dollars of an industry in e-games and e-sports, and I feel like we have too often said, no, let's just follow the traditional path and go the way as is expected, and then you can make those decisions. And I feel as though educators can be more proactive in that way and foster those interests and that love, because inevitably ended up saving me from the hurt heart of these programs was finding a love and a passion. And following that passion always superseded and overpowered my desire to have a drink or try a drug or go out and party.
Is there anything else that you would like to include that you want the listeners to know?
I think that a lot of people point to me, a former staff journalist at the New York Times, published author, as someone who is exemplary of the program's positive attributes. I really don't think that's the case. I have been very lucky, and I have been very blessed to be able to get to where I am today, but it was not without a lot of hurt on my part and the part of others. And I've struggled for many years and continue to struggle into the future to deal with things that, when looking back, began very much at those programs.
Kenneth R. Rosen has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, VQR, and The Atlantic. He is also a contributing writer at Wired. The name of his new book is Troubled: The Failed Promise of America's Behavioral Treatment Programs. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Elizabeth Hill. Here in the USA, using gender-neutral language usually means finding gender-neutral pronouns. But there are languages around the world that have a much more binary approach to gender. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do languages of the past stack up to today's new social norms? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Deborah Bennett, professor of liberal arts at the Berklee College of Music, explores limits of teaching languages with only male or female pronouns.
As educators in the United States seeking to create a more inclusive environment, Romance language instructors are caught in a bind. Languages like Spanish and French are rooted in a binary vision of the world. People, objects, adjectives, and articles are either male or female. In English, the discussion around gender-neutral language focuses on pronouns. In Romance languages, it is more complicated. The evolution of the discussion of gender-neutral language in French and Spanish starts with the efforts of feminists who have sought to create gender-inclusive terms to make women more visible in language and not rely on the masculine form as the universal marker for all people. Efforts to create gender-neutral forms have come out of the LGBTQ community and the younger generation. Early adopters of non-binary language in Spanish use symbols such as the at sign or an X in place of the masculine O and feminine A endings, a famous example being Latinx. However, the question of pronunciation in spoken language creates a challenge, and recent efforts have focused on the E ending, which is already gender neutral. The academies that regulate Spanish and French have rejected these, quote, unnecessary changes and insist that the masculine is, oxymoronically, gender neutral. As researchers and language instructors, we have been forced to make a choice between the standards issued by the academy and the need to acknowledge the existence of women and genderqueer individuals in the classroom. We discovered that these norms are being developed in places such as Quebec and Argentina, thus making it clear that change is being driven by stakeholders of the language and culture. This conversation is only just beginning, and as the use of gender-inclusive and gender-neutral language takes root in the Spanish and French-speaking worlds, we expect to see even more evolution of these living languages.
That was Deborah Bennett of the Berklee College of Music. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.